Okay, so Doug had a question last week, which we thought was interesting, apropos, you know, certainly for Noah Hyde, because it has to do with monetary issues, and the Noah Hyde law includes, of course, stealing. So damages would be, you know, monetary. A monetary issue in terms of you can't destroy somebody's property. And you see that Maimonides has cases that are listed in his book, the Mishnah Torah, in terms of damages, stealing property, and then let's say you're only causally involved in the damage. So would you still be considered? That was where we started from last week, was the person who's only contributing to some sort of a loss, is that considered something that you're culpable for? The cases that you had was feeding somebody who's like a mafioso. He comes into your restaurant, and you're just giving him food, but because you're giving him strength, then he's got the ability to hurt people that day. Or if you somebody hires you to write their term paper for medical school, and years later, because of that term paper that you did, just because he becomes a doctor, but he's ignorant, and then he does a botched surgery, and he hurts somebody, or kills somebody, even worse. So was your act of writing the paper something which you are now obligated for, that you're culpable for? So as I mentioned, so there's a whole work that Nachmanides, Ramban, had put together on the different areas, many areas in the Talmud, called contributive damages. When you're only contributing, you're not the sole cause. So there's many cases and many examples of how you might contribute. So what we'll do is we'll start going through a few, and we'll see if we can formulate some sort of a rule that would help us apply it in other cases. All right. So let's just do one case that the Ramban starts with. I give somebody a coin. I'm paying them back for something, or I'm buying something. And in the days of the Talmud, you didn't have any type of currency amount stamped on the coin. You know, whether or not it was a 1950 quarter or a 2010 quarter, they're both equally of equal value right now. All right, even if one is worn out to half its size, it's still going to be representing the amount. But back then in the Talmud, it wasn't that way. So let's say that John gives to Jack a coin. All right, so Jack says back to him, is this a good coin? Because the question is now, what's the value of this? Is it pure silver? Is it still a little bit of dross in there? So it's not really the best silver. So, you know, I'm John, I'm giving to Jack the coin. And Jack asked me this question, so I respond, and I tell him, well, you assess the value and go on your assessment. And the Talmud quotes this and says that the reason why I'm doing this is because, this is on the tractate Talmud, the Bava Kamma 100a. So the reason why I say this is because if I tell you the value and I substantiate its value by verbally committing, yes, this is a good value, and then you go out and you want to use a coin and somebody tells you, hey, this coin that you give me is not good, go back to John and tell him that. So I don't want to have that responsibility. So what I do is a wise maneuver. I'm giving you the coin. You determine whether you want to take it or not. If you do, now all the responsibility for its value is off my shoulders. But if I take the responsibility and I say, yes, it's a good coin, it's a good going rate coin, and then you know Jack comes back to me a week later or a month later and says, hey, I tried to use it, and they said it was only worth 50% of what you say it is. So then it might cause a loss to Jack, and Jack will come back and say, hey, you know, you owe me another 50% on what you gave me. But again, if I don't make that substantiation, I don't claim the value, and I say, listen, Jack, here's the coin, you determine the worth. If you're happy with it, that's it. We're done. I paid you back. So what we're now going to do is try to understand both sides. One side would be that I would be obligated. I mean, that would the side where I told Jack, you assess the value, there's no question. I'm off the hook. So the case that we're discussing then would be where I take the responsibility and I say, yes, this is a coin of good value. So the question would be, how do we explain both sides? One side, A, would be where Jack comes back to me and he says I got to pay him and I'd have to. I'd be obligated. The other side would be an argument that would say, I'm not obligated. So what we want to understand is, you know, if we can get both sides, great. But let's just take the primary side we're interested in is, why would I be obligated? Or what is the determination? What is the question at hand whether or not I would be obligated to give him more money? And what would be, meaning what are the factors that would determine that I'm not the sole cause of his loss in this case? I'm only partial. Evidently, this is a case where I'm partially involved in his loss. If it's clear cut, if I go over to his car and I firebomb his car and it's destroyed, there's no question by anybody. I got to pay him back for the car. Maybe even inconvenience, who knows? So we're not talking about a case where it's clear cut. We're talking about a case where I'm only causally involved. I give the mattress to somebody and he firebombs the car. All right, that would be a similar type of case. Let's just take the case that we're at. I got the coin, I give it to him, he asks me the value, and I take responsibility, I tell him, yes, this is a coin of X value, and he goes ahead and uses it, and he ends up that it's really not that value, according to another merchant, and he comes back and he claims, I got to give him more. So what are the factors involved that determine that I am only partially liable? All right, everybody's got the question at least.
Rabbi, wouldn't it be in part because you, in accepting the coin, you relied on the information he provided as to its value, and had that information not been clear, or you had known that it was not the value that he said, you would not have accepted the coin.
So Jack had accepted the information I gave him. Okay, how does that affect whether I'm partially liable or not? Why is it partial?
Yeah, why partial as opposed to totally?
Yeah.
Because perhaps Jack, you're partially liable because Jack relied on the information, but Jack is also partially liable because he didn't do his own research.
Okay, good.
And determined it independently.
Right. So, he didn't have to use me exclusively. So you can't pin it all on me. All right, so that's one case. One case with his partial involvement. Now, let's take the case that I gave you, Doug. I had sent you an email. And this was in the laws of, this is in my mind, these laws, the Mishnah Torah, all right, and the laws of Gezeila and Aveda, which is stealing and losses. And this is chapter 9, and we'll read through the first three laws, and we'll see how this relates to the question at hand in terms of, you know, partial liability. Okay, so it says in law, in chapter 9, law 1, that a person steals land from somebody and he destroys it. For example, he digs holes in it, in pits, in trenches, and alleys or valleys, or you know, he cuts down all the trees, or he cuts off all the springs of water, and he destroys all the structures that are on the field that he stole. So then he is obligated to
to restore everything to the way it was at the time that he stole it, or he pays its worth of what he damaged. Okay, very simple. I destroy property, land, or I destroy the houses on or the trees or any type of beneficial portion of it, right? Springs of water, so on and so forth. So I am obligated to pay back or to restore it to its gate. Like, for example, if I made trenches, I could fix the trenches. If I destroyed a house, I could rebuild a house, so on and so forth. Or give the monetary value. However, if it was destroyed on its own, meaning it's still the case where I stole the field, that means I pushed the guy off the field, and now I'm settling there by force. Because you can't just pick up a field and run. So stealing here must be where you're forcing the landowner off, and you're taking physical control of it. Now, but if, after I stole it, I don't destroy it, but it becomes destroyed by itself naturally. For example, that there was a great flood in the area, and it flooded out the field, and all the crops were lost. Or it was burnt by a brimstone or fiery type of meteors that came down. So in such a case, even though I stole it, and while it was in my forceful possession, it just got destroyed from natural causes, I can tell the owner, right, we use the same names again, my name is John, and Jack is the owner, so I tell Jack, here, here's your field back. I move off the property because I don't want it anymore. And I'm not obligated to him even a penny. Why? Because the fields are in the status of the owners, that they remain there. And there's no obligation of destruction that I must pay him unless I do it with my own hands. All right? So in this case, it appears that the destruction is something which, you know, the Rambam says that the fields are really didn't do anything effectively. It was never really transferred. A field is not something which is immovable. That's a different category of property. There's movable items, and then there's immovables, there's land. So land is never really removed out of the ownership. When I destroyed it in the first case, it was still Jack's land, but I just made trenches and pits and so on and so forth, so I got to pay for that. And what Maimonides is saying here is that in this second case, since it was a natural disaster, so the natural disaster was really visiting... It was visiting the field of the original owner. So I really played no role whatsoever. All right? Is that clear?
Yep.
All right. Which is not the case by movable items, he says. We're not going to go into that. Okay, that's the first law. The second law. A person steals a field. And then somebody else steals it from him. So I go with the Jack. I steal his field. Then tomorrow, Bob steals it from me. He throws me off the land. But then the next day, we live in a town where it's a dictatorship, and it's the tax collectors come and they confiscate the field from Bob. All right, so I steal it from Jack. Jack is the rightful owner. I steal the field from him. The next day, Bob steals it from me. And the next day, the king's tax collectors take it from Bob. And he says, in this case, that for example, when the kings come in, they take fields or houses by force of, you know, everybody in the town. So I can go back to Jack and say to Jack, hey, your field is over there. I'm out of this picture because I'm not obligated at all. That's what Maimonides says here. Because now we'll have to define why that is. Why is it in this case? I mean, didn't I steal the field from Jack? Yes. So Bob stole it from me, and then the king took it from the king's tax collectors. They took it from Bob. But how come I'm off the hook? Right? But he says, but if, however, the king took it from Bob because they had a lien on Bob's property, then they're not going to take it from anybody else. Everybody else is paying their taxes in the kingdom, so they're all fine. But Bob was one guy who was not paying his taxes, so I stole the field from Jack. Jack then steals it from me. But the king's collectors now are keeping an eye on Bob, and they see he's now maintaining a new field that they never saw him maintaining before. Oh, so they go ahead and they take it. That ended up to be Jack's field that I stole. So then I am obligated to pay in that case. So again, the difference in the two cases is the facts are the same, up to the point of the motivation of the king. The facts are Jack has a field. I oust Jack off his field and I take it over. Next day, Bob pushes me off, he steals the field. And then the next day, the king's tax collectors come in and they take it from Bob. Now, if they're taking it from Bob because they just go around taking fields in general, nothing to do with Bob specifically, so I'm off the hook as being the first crook. But if they're taking it from Bob because they have a beef only with Bob, then I am obligated. I've got to pay back. Because now the field has gone on into the king's possession. That's it. Jack, the original owner, is not getting it back. Either case is not getting it back. But is it because they would have taken it anyway? Whether it changed hands? Because they just go around collecting fields as a forcible tax? Or they only took it because they saw that Bob was now maintaining it, and they had this lien on Bob's property. They had Bob not maintained it, so it never would have been into the king's property. All right, are the facts clear, first of all? Everybody's got it?
I think so.
All right, so again, you got four parties involved. You get the original owner, which is Jack. I steal it from him, Bob steals it from me, and then the king collects it from Bob. So I am off the hook if they were going to steal it anyway. It doesn't matter whether it was Bob's property, whether it was my property, or whether it was in Jack's property. But if they only took the field because it ended up in Bob's hands, now I am obligated to pay. Now, what's the difference?
John are obligated to pay, or you, Bob, are obligated to pay?
John, me. I'm the second. I'm the first crook. I take it from the rightful owner, from Jack.
So, Jack's the original owner, John's the first robber, Bob's the second robber, and you're saying that if the king puts a lien on it because of Bob, you as the first robber are obligated to pay.
Yeah.
That's not what Halakha 2 says, though.
No, I'll read it again. I steal a field from Jack. Then it's stolen from me. Okay.
Are you reading out of the Mishnah Torah?
Yeah. Does it start off that way? If one steals a field and it's stolen.
No, this one translates the case differently.
Yeah,
not case? Just the words, but the facts.
What are the facts you have?
This one says the following rules apply when a person robbed a colleague of a field and it was in turn. I'm sorry. I misread it. Okay. Well, in the case where the king seized it just because he's seizing everybody's land.
Right.
I can understand why the robbers are not held responsible because essentially the land ownership never changes from its original owner. So he's obligated, similarly as in the first halakha, for whatever happens naturally to the land. And the king taking over everybody's land is kind of a natural thing that has nothing to do with the robbers themselves.
Good. It's inevitable. It has nothing to do. My act of, squatting on the land and moving this guy off really played no role whatsoever. The king was going to take it anyway. So I did nothing at all to cause the damage. The damage was that it ultimately was seized by the king, and that's it. Once the king has it, you are not getting it back. But if it's a case where I stole it from Jack, and then Bob steals it from me, and the only reason why the king took it now was because it ended up in Bob's hands, now I'm obligated to pay. Why am I obligated? What's that?
Why you? Why not Bob?
Good question. But I thought I was the one asking the questions today.
Yes, I'm.
Give me a break over here. Let's see.
Rabbi, in your translation, is it absolutely clear that it's the first robber that's responsible, not the second?
It seems that way to me because he's talking about the original crook. Here's what I can get, just to make 100%.
Because the way mine is translated, it says the following rules apply when a purser robs a colleague of a field, and it was in turn taken from him by robbery.
Right.
They'll stop there. That's the fact they said. And then at the end it says, if, however, it was confiscated because of the robber is obligated. So they never identify whether it's the first robber or the second robber.
Well, they're not giving you an exact translation. That's a problem. Let me read you exactly. I'll read it in the whole law, too. If one steals a field and it's stolen from him, okay, so that's like I said, I steal a field from Jack, then Bob steals it from me, and then the tax collectors take it by force of the king. So if it's a tax of the king, for example, that the king is taking all the fields and houses of all the people of the city, so I could now say, I could say to him, your field is before you. Now, who's the one that's saying that? Evidently, that's the one, me. I'm the one who initially took it from Jack. Bob is not going to say, hey, here's the field before you. He didn't take it from Jack. He took it from me. So by the fact that Maimonides says that he can say to him, here, your field is before you, meaning to say that I'm off the hook from taking it from Jack. So it only makes sense to say that if we're talking about John, the first crook, not the second crook. Because he doesn't even know who he is. Right? Bob can't say. He doesn't know who I got it from. He just stole it from me. So how could Bob possibly say to Jack, here, your field is before you? He does not have a relationship with Jack. So it must be it's the first crook. And that's what we're trying to understand is, what role does he play in this?
Well, it would seem that he's the causative agent for the problem.
Yeah, how? How's he causative?
If he had not originally stolen the land, then Bob, the king wouldn't be assessing Bob for it.
Exactly. Meaning, since I played a role, it was due to me, I was essentially a cause. Meaning, my stealing it alone did not ruin the land, or I could always give it back. But because I stole it, then Bob was able to steal it from me. If it was not in my possession, so then Bob would not have taken it from me. So it only got to Bob, and then ultimately to the king, because of my initial action. So we see that I played a role, an essential role. I was a cause in terms of why Jack is now without a field. Is that clear, everybody?
All
right, Jim?
Yeah, I think it's Bob ends up totally off the hook there.
Yeah. Right, now there's an interesting phenomenon here is that we're being told this because you might have thought otherwise. Like you were saying, you might have thought it was really Bob. That's the one who the king took it from. If it never got into Bob's hands, would the field be lost to the king? No, it would not, right?
Why could Bob have taken the field whether or not Jack had lost the child first? I mean, if Jack still owns the field, why could Bob have taken it from him? How do we know that he's taking the field
case that, that Maimonides has. Evidently, he seems to be telling you that, I mean, why even tell me that, that, that Bob took it? Why can't it just be I stole it from Jack, and then the king took it from me? Because Maimonides is trying to show you that even though there's another crook involved, that does not diminish the cause that I played in the loss. I mean, you have to understand, you have to ask that question. Why is there a case over here where there's two crooks? I steal from Jack, and the king takes it from me. So if it's where the king has a beef with me, right, isn't that a sufficient case to show that I'm liable? But it's trying to show you, even if there's a second crook involved, you might have thought, oh, well, there's a second crook involved, so now that diminishes my liability. But why? Let's define the factors. What would be the reasoning behind the argument to say, oh, when Bob's involved, so now the you know, maybe I'm off the hook a bit. Now, Jim, just tell me your question one more time. You're asking that with Bob, even if he stole it straight from Jack, so then he'd be obligated. But we're trying to construct a case here where we're talking about John, the first guy, me. Meaning, is my involvement in any way mitigated by the fact that there's a second crook that comes into the picture? The answer is no. But there's a thought, you might have thought, yes. Now the question is, why would it be thought yes? What happens? What is introduced when you have the second crook? There's a new element that's introduced. And here's where you start seeing, you know, the beauty of how the Torah understands the true realities behind phenomena that take place. Monetary laws and laws between man and his fellow man. There's different phenomena that go on. For example, I take something from Jack. I take a seal. So that is now called the removing his ability to express dominion. Domain. Right? There's something called domain. Still on? Okay, we got a call back in. Okay, hold on. We'll call right back in. So you have to define what are the two issues over here. Why would you blame the first crook, or why would you blame the second crook?
mean, in terms of...
That is the ball rolling, so to speak. We're all in it together. The first sex body is the second one to step through. And so on.
I'm not sure I hear you too clearly.
Yeah, it's a very good speech. And but I the first step is to make sure I can help you hear you. Can I stay in the computer now?
It's hard to hear you. Do you have another phone you can use? Or if somebody hears her better, you can tell me what she's saying? It sounded like you're saying that the first one got the ball rolling. Is that what you said?
Yes, the first one started it. If the first one hasn't started it, then they didn't put in the test.
Okay, well, you're on the track, but I want to give it the halachic definitions, and you'll see what I mean. See, why are we being told that if I steal the field and somebody steals it from me, and then the king takes it, why do you need a second crook in there? So we're trying to show you that it doesn't matter that there was a second crook. Why? Because what I did already was enough to be culpable. So what did I do? I didn't cause the field to ultimately be lost, the loss of monetary value. There's two things that go on in this transaction. There's the original removal of the property from the domain of the owner. So one thing is to remove the owner from having expression of ownership. So that's what the first crook does. That is the new quality that he brings into the equation. He is the one that is removing the rightful expression of ownership from the owner. Right? It's the second guy, the second crook, though, that because of him, then the property is ultimately lost. There's a loss of capital. That's a separate thing. Meaning there's the prevention of an owner to express his ownership over property. That's one aspect of stealing. Another aspect of stealing is if I take somebody's property and I blow it up, I destroy it. So now the monetary value is lost. So what Maimonides is telling you here is that don't think that you have to be the one that was the ultimate cause of the loss. That was really due to Bob that the king took it. Because the king was only putting a lien on Bob. Everybody else in the country was fine. So the loss of the value was due to Bob, not due to me. But that doesn't matter, because in terms of the Torah law, what is the cause for, why am I obligated? What makes me liable? When I prevent a rightful owner from expressing ownership on his property. So if I sever that relationship, that is what causes my obligation to pay. You see the difference?
Thank you.
It's very interesting. You know, you don't even think of it. You just think it's an act, a physical act. If you just look at the act, he took this money, right? Like you were talking before, Doug. You were saying that the guy steals jewelry. He does a heist. And then some other crooks take from him. Now, what is American law going to say in that case? Let's say they catch both parties. Let's say they catch both parties. And they find the second crook holding the gems. And me, I'm the first crook. I don't have anything. Are they going to tell both of us to pay back $100,000 each if the total stolen was only $100,000? They're not going to make the owner have $200,000, that's for sure. So what are they going to do? They're going to take the jewels from
the first thief.
What's that?
Blame the first thief.
They're going to blame the first, but they have the jewels now. Let's say they recover it. They have both crooks in the possession, and they have the jewelry.
But they're still going to hold the first thief responsible. He committed an act of robbery.
Right. He committed an act of robbery. And what will they do? They'll take the jewels from the second thief. And the second thief, he stole it from the thief. Now, what are they going to say? Did he do anything wrong? Yeah, they'll say aided and abetted or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And in terms of what the amount...
stolen property.
Yeah, they'll give the property back to the jewelry store, whatever he stole it from. And then they'll give, you know, punitive measures separately. But you see, in terms of the Rambam says, Maimonides says here, based on the Talmud, of course. So the first one has the payback. The second one doesn't. All right, interesting, right? Let's do another case. And again, we'll have to learn, I think, a number of cases before we start formulating anything, because you have another case I was looking at this morning. I remember, because we had done this years ago. I had given the class. And let's say, Doug, you get a document that gives you rights to make a claim. You have an agreement with somebody, and they faulted, and the document is the proof for you to get your $100. I come along, I light a match to the document, and I burn the whole thing. So there's a case where I only have to pay you for the paper. All right, another case would be where I've got to pay you for the whole $100 too, because I caused you not to be able to collect, because that was a proof of your ability to collect. So I just want to see how varied the role of being a causal agent can be. Okay, let's do another case over here. This is law number 3 now. We're still in laws of stealing and losses. And this is chapter 9, law 3. Let's say, same case, I steal a field. All right, now it's only one crook. I steal it from Jack. I've got the field in my possession. Now the king comes along, and he says to me, show me everything you own, because you're going to pay me something that you owe me. So I show him all the fields, and I include your field too, meaning Jack's field. I include that in what I show. Right? And the king takes it. So now I am obligated to pay for the field, just like it. Or pay its value. Okay, so the reason why he has this case is now because I didn't just show him the field that took from Jack. Then clearly I'm obligated. It's basically like handing him the field in his hand. But I showed him 10 fields, and one of those fields is Jack. So the king's the one who decided which field to take. So you see how the fact that there are 9 other fields in what I present to the king, you might think it'll mitigate my responsibility. I didn't say, hey, take Jack's field. I said, here's 10 fields. Take whichever one you want to pay my back taxes. But he picks that one. He picks the one that I stole from Jack. I am still obligated. Why? You tell me.
Well, why wouldn't I be obligated? I mean, I stole the field. The king's confiscated it.
Because it was the king's choice. It was the king's decision to take that field. I didn't tell him to take that field.
I think we have to ask if the first owner owned any taxes on it first.
No, we got to assume it's a clean slate. We don't want to introduce anything in the case that's not there.
All right, so then if the first owner originally didn't own anything on it, so then there shouldn't have been any loss to him. Now there's a loss due to the cause of the second person that took possession of his field.
Right. So you're right. Right, since he paid the loss. So you're right. Both you and Doug are right that the fact is that I was an essential cause, right? My role was essential for the field now to be lost and taken by the government. If I was not playing a role, it would not be there. Even though I wasn't the exclusive cause, I was essential to it. So you see that this is something which the Talmud goes at great length. There's a tremendous amount written on this in terms of whether you have to be an exclusive cause or just a contributing cause. But now why don't we stop for a second and ask that question. What is the thinking behind such a question? Meaning when we say, do you need to be the exclusive cause or can you just be a contributing cause? What theory underlies that very question? What considerations?
Well, one of the things that I notice in these cases is that the person held responsible seems to be the initial cause.
Okay, I'm glad you said initial, because that's going to be the next thing we're going to take up. You mean initial in terms of the first in terms of the sequence of time, right?
Right. In other words, the first robber that takes something away from the rightful owner, and then maybe it passes through 17 other robbers, it appears in these cases that the first robber is the one himself liable to repay the owner.
All right, and we explain that to be because me being the first robber, I am the one that prevented the owner from expressing ownership. I didn't cause the monetary loss because the field is intact. Even after a year of stealing the field, it's still a healthy field. So it's not that you have to pay back because you destroyed property. Is you pay back because you remove the owner from expressing ownership on something. He no longer has access to his property. So even removing access without destroying the value makes me liable.
And I assume that the case three that you just gave, where the king comes along, looks at all the property, and confiscates that one piece, that's different than the first case where the king confiscates everybody's property, or maybe the second, whichever one that was. Because if the king had confiscated everybody's property, then the original landowner would have lost it anyway.
Exactly.
It's like the natural occurrence of the hurricane or the storm or whatever. But in the third case, it isn't clear that the original owner would have lost it, but the king would have confiscated that particular piece anyway, and therefore the robber's held liable.
Right. Yeah, in that third case, so I'm contributing not only to the removal of the expression of ownership, but I'm also contributing to the loss of property, meaning both parts of the equation. I guess we'll have to see a case. Well, let's say I steal an object from you, and then another guy comes over and he takes that object and he blows it up. Who's going to pay you back? Because I just removed it from your ability to express ownership. I removed it from your domain. But I didn't destroy the object per se, the monetary value. I did not do anything to. So we'll have to see. We'll have to find a case like that now.
Are there any cases where somebody, it's not a theft, but it's just that someone comes along and destroys the property? That's pretty cut and dry, right?
Yeah, that for sure. You got to pay back. I go to your house and I destroy something of yours without removing it from your house. Of course, I got to pay you for it.
Is that a case where different cases where you have to pay back double, triple, four?
That's something else.
With a bow and calf or an ox.
Yeah, that's different.
Something like that. Is there anything like that we're discussing?
No, that's a different question altogether. What?
Is that like paying back double? Is there any cases where you discuss about paying back double?
Yeah, when a crook steals something.
You have to destroy someone's property or steal someone's property. Don't they have to pay back double?
Yeah, but that's a different question. Right now, we're just staying involved in, we're focusing on when you are partially involved in damages. We're not getting into the discussion right now about, penalties of double and triple. That we're not doing right now. All right?
Okay.
Okay, so now let's take a look at the case of, also in the Maimonides' work, the Mishneh Torah. This is in the laws of damages, injury and damages. This is the seventh chapter, right? In Hebrew, it's Chovel Umazik. Chovel Umazik, chapter 7. Okay. Now, he says, 7-7, right? Chapter 7, law 7, reads as follows. Anybody who causes damages to money of his friend, he has to pay him back the complete amount from the best of his own property, like all other damages. Okay, again, if I cause damage to somebody else, I've got to pay you back for the best of my property. And it says, even though, this is a little tricky reading here. Even though this one who damages at first is not causing the ultimate damage, it seems to be saying, but he is the first one, right? He's the initial one. So then he's going to be obligated. Now, let's do the case. Right, Brian, he gave a theory, but let's have some cases here. Okay. Here's a case. I am standing on my roof, or any roof, right? And I'm holding let's say, a glass, a beautiful glass vase in my hand. And it's my vase. And I throw it off the top of this roof. I'm 60 flights up, and I throw it off the top of this roof. But I'm throwing it onto a cushioned area. I put on the ground a whole bunch of pillows. All right? So let's make it more practical. I'm 2 flights up. All right? So 2 flights up is enough that if I throw a glass vase, it's going to shatter if it hits the cement. But I don't. I put a whole bunch of pillows. So the ground is perfectly cushioned. Okay? Again, it's my vase. And then somebody else comes along and it removes all the pillows. Right? I've already thrown it. It's in flight. And then while it's in flight, somebody very quickly removes the pillows. And then the glass vase, of course, shatters. So, it's my vase. I was throwing it onto a pillowed area. If it would have landed, it would have been safe. Therefore, the person who removed the pillows has to pay me full amount. So if the vase was $100, this person who removed the pillows has to pay me $100. Because it's just like he took a hammer and smashed the vase with his own hands. And he explains. Because the removal of the pillows and the cushions was the cause that broke this. And similarly, all such cases. All right? Second case. I go back to the same roof, and I don't take my vase, but now I take my friend's vase, and I throw it off the roof. And I put the pillows down there again. And then my friend, right? So he comes along. Right, again, I'm on top of the roof. I've got my friend's vase in my hand, and I throw it off. And before it hits the ground, my friend, who owns the vase, he removes all the pillows. So now I, being the one who threw the vase, what would you say? Am I obligated to pay or not?
Did you take it without his knowledge?
He doesn't say. He does not say here whether it's with his knowledge or not. But I don't think it matters, because certainly the guy doesn't want his property damaged. So whether I took it with his permission or not, even if I took it with his permission, but he certainly didn't give it to me to go on the roof and shatter it. But it's his vase, I throw it, and now this guy, even though it's his vase, he now moves all the pillows away, because he happens to know this law. And what's going to happen? I have to pay him back. Why? Because my throwing was the initial cause for the breaking of this vessel. Now look what he says. In both cases, he calls it initial. Rishon means first, but it could mean primary. So it doesn't mean that you're the first in the cause, because in the case where it's my vase and I throw it off the roof, and then somebody else comes along and removes the pillows all the way, so the removal of the pillows is now what causes it. He doesn't say the throwing of the vase causes it. It's my vase in that case. So the question we have to tackle now is, why is it in a case where I own the vase and I throw it off and somebody else removes the pillows, that person is really, he has to pay me. But if it's the second case where I throw the vase and it's somebody else's vase, the same thing happens. The person removes the pillows. Right? It's the same case, same two people involved. It's just in one case I'm throwing my vase, and the second case I'm throwing your vase. So when I'm throwing your vase and you remove the pillows, you think, well, why isn't it like the first case? The guy in the first case removed the pillows, Rambam says, Maimonides says, that he's the one that caused it. He's the one that caused the damage.
Well, you threw somebody else's vase. You don't have the right to do that to someone else's property to begin with.
Okay, good. But with my own property, I do, right?
what you want, it's mine.
Right, so if I have my own vase and I'm throwing it, and I'm throwing it to these pillows, so somebody else comes along and removes the pillows. So I just want to show you, you can't use the argument that in both cases, I was throwing it at pillows. So therefore, I didn't do anything wrong. If everything would have stayed status quo, in both cases, the vase would have been fine, correct? Because in both cases, I'm throwing it right on the pillows, and there's plenty of pillows. Nothing would have happened to the vase. So you can't use the argument that I initiated a very safe treatment of the vase. Because you see in one case, you know, if I'm throwing somebody else's vase, so even though he removes the pillows, right, and he's really, it seems like he's causing the damage. No, in that case, we don't say the guy removing the pillows caused the damage. When it's not my vase, I cause the damage. I now become the primary cause of damage. So we have to understand why in one case we say the guy who removed the pillows, he is the cause of damage, right? That's when it's my vase. But when I throw his vase and then the same thing happens, he removes the pillows again, now all of a sudden I'm the one that's the primary cause of damage.
We have to assume that there is no right for you to take the vase of the second owner.
I'm getting feedback. You got to turn off the speaker by your computer there.
Sorry about that.
You did it again.
The second situation is you didn't have any right to take the vase from where it was sitting on the guy's shelf. Nothing would have happened to it.
Well, let's say the guy, he gave me the vase, but he didn't think I was going to throw it off a roof. And I wasn't even intending.
Well, think of empathy for a vase and off roof.
Let's say I was not even intending to break the vase. I was just playing a game, and I just like throwing vases off the roof onto pillows. Right? So I didn't even intend to break it.
You know that?
I didn't know that the guy's going to come along and remove the pillows. So I'm not even doing any type of...
No, but the owner of the second vase knows that you do this with vases.
It doesn't matter.
You do it with watermelon too?
Anything. Watermelons, vases, does not matter.
Okay.
So you see that even though I had no intent to break it, I'm now obligated. So I think you're right, you were saying.
It has nothing to do with intention to break it. You have no business taking something that wasn't his and playing with it, in a sense.
No, I had rights. The owner gave me the vase. He says, do what you want with it. You know, don't break it, of course. So I don't break it. I go to the roof and I'm just throwing it onto the cushions. There's no intent to break this thing whatsoever. But the owner comes along and now he
removes it. The owner is also assuming that you are not going to break it and you're going to take care of it.
But I am taking care of it. I'm not doing anything negligible. There's nothing wrong that I did that's negligent.
Well, it's kind of out of the ordinary to throw it off the roof. He's an onto cushions.
It doesn't matter. I was not putting the vase in harm's way at all.
I don't agree with that.
Your way?
Well, it's been there for roof.
So you're saying I did put it in harm's way.
But it's a case. It's just a case. And it's designed to help us, I think, to discriminate between kind of one causation and another.
Right.
I mean, it could be that you know, I was borrowing a table from my neighbor, and he had loaned it to me, and then something happened to the table, which wouldn't have happened if the owner hadn't done something. Maybe he tripped me or, you know, something.
Mm-hmm.
The question of who's liable and why.
Okay, let me give you the third case. The third case, he says, that in the second case has a modification. I borrow or I get your vase with your permission. I go to the roof. I set up all the pillows before I go to the roof. I throw it off, and before it hits the ground, some stranger walks along and moves the pillows. Who's obligated to pay for the broken vase in this case?
The
And the owner is now, he went to San Diego. So it's just me, his vase, I'm throwing it, I'm going to throw it onto the cushions. Nothing's going to happen if nobody comes along. Then some stranger comes along, moves the pillows, kicks them out of the way, and now the vase is shattered. Who's got to pay?
The third party that kicked away the pillows know that someone was throwing the vase off the roof onto them?
Doesn't matter. Doesn't say that he knows. Doesn't say that he knows.
We have to assume that he doesn't know.
Well, I would say just the opposite.
He took the pillows out of the way that was sitting on the sidewalk.
I would assume he does know, because it sounds a little bit strange, oh, intuitively. I see some pillows on the ground. Hey, these are good-looking pillows. Let me pick them up. I have no idea. I've got to expect that there are vases flying out of this apartment building every day? No, I would say forget it. So, but the answer is that in this case, both me and the guy who removed the pillows have to pay. Because Ram says they're both obligated, the thrower and the one who kicked the pillows away, because they both caused the destruction of money of the owner. Now, why don't I say if the owner removed the pillows? I mean, what's the difference if it's the owner that removed the pillows or it's a stranger who moved the pillows? It sounds like Maimonides is saying that you're both involved in the destruction of money. So you'll tell me.
Yeah, but you have the right to destroy your own property.
Right, exactly. So the owner has a right to destroy his own property. If that's true, I have a right to destroy. So why is it in that middle case when the owner comes along and removes the pillows that the guy who threw it is still going to pay? If I've got the right to destroy, so that's what he's saying, that the owner really did the act of destruction, removing the pillows, so why is the guy who threw it obligated to pay?
The second case was that the owner threw it and someone else removed the pillows.
The first case is where I throw my own vase. All
right?
If I throw my own vase and then somebody comes along and he removes the pillows, so then that guy who removed the pillows has got to pay me. The second case is what I'm asking now. Well, I don't throw my own vase, I throw your vase. And then you come along before the vase hits the pillows and you remove the pillows. So why do I got to pay you in that
case? Maybe if you have no right to destroy or put at risk, maybe that's the issue. If you're putting it at risk, because there is a possibility, obviously, that maybe you'll miss the pillows, maybe the pillows will get blown away by the wind. You're doing something that's not naturally done with a glass vase. It shouldn't be done. So that's why, in the second case, I think that's why you're liable.
Okay.
So, you know, if the one that throws them off the roof, the vase off the roof is liable.
All right, so let's go back to Maimonides' original statement over here. His original statement in 7.7 in the laws of injury and damage, right? Chovel umazik. So this is what he says in 7.7, right in the beginning. Anybody who causes damages of money to his friend, he's obligated to pay. That's it. So if we just stick to the original formulation, in the case where I own the first case, I own the vase, I throw it off on the pillows. You come along and kick the pillows away. You were just a causal, you were now causally related. I don't care how little the cause was. You were causally related to the damage of this vase. Period. Exactly as the formulation in Mani says. Second case, I don't own the vase, you own the vase, but I take your vase, or I borrow it from you with your permission, and I throw it off the roof, and then you come along and you move the pillows away. Now it's true, you did the same exact thing as the first guy, but in this case, I'm still a cause, meaning when I threw it off my own vase, I was a cause. I wasn't the exclusive cause. There were two things needed for the vase to break in this case. You need somebody to launch it from the roof, and you need the pillows to be removed on the ground. There's two causes. So when I own it, so it doesn't matter. You have to understand here that since there are two causes in the destruction of the vase, so when one of the people that is a cause is not the owner, so he's got to pay. Okay, very simple. If we just keep to that formulation, I'm getting feedback, so we just put the mute buttons on. Thanks. So the point is that since there are two causal parties. The two parties that are contributing to the damage here. The one who throws it off the roof and the one who kicks the pills away. So if any one of those parties is not an owner, since they're causally contributing to the damage, they must now pay. If we look at it that way, it's very, very clear. And if we go to the last case, where I borrow your vase, I throw it off the roof, and some stranger comes along and kicks the pills away, so now you have two people that are not owners that are contributing to the destruction of the vase. So both people have to pay. Each one of us has got to give. Maybe it's half each. Who knows? Whatever it is. Okay.
You're saying that the basic denominator here is ownership.
No. The basic phenomena here is that when you contribute to damage, when you have a contributing role to the damage of something, so then you're liable.
And you're not the owner.
Right. Of course.
Okay.
Even if the owner contributed, you might think, well, if he contributed, see, that's the hard case. I throw his object off the roof, and he removes the pillows. I mean, it sounds like he's going to be the exclusive cause. That's not true. He's not the exclusive cause. If I was not throwing it off, there's no way that this thing could break. So even though he contributed, you've got to pay. That one is the toughest case for me to grasp. But I see, just in terms of the logical categories. But you see that this discussion here is only talking about monetary loss. Whereas originally we were talking about one guy stealing a field from another, there's something else which comes into play. There's the fact that I removed the ability for ownership to be expressed. So that's also something which the Torah views as making you liable. Now let's say I steal a field from you, somebody steals it from him, whatever, but you end up getting it back. Do I have to pay you anything? I mean, didn't I prevent you from having expression of ownership for a certain amount of time? Maybe I did, but...
Is there any monetary loss?
No monetary loss, so you can't really pin anything on me, would be my guess. We'll have to see if we can find a case like that, but I would say I don't owe you anything because you now have the field back in its full value. All right, so you didn't have access to it for a week. But you can't say that my removal of your ownership to express ownership resulted in anything. It still has to result in something. It's not purely the fact that I remove your ownership, your expression of ownership. The king has to ultimately take it, so it has to ultimately be destroyed by my own hands. But if it was destroyed naturally, it would have happened anyway, so I'm off the hook. Or if you get it back into your hands, again, nothing resulted from the fact that I prevented you from expressing ownership for a week. So you can't pin anything on me. So you do need both. But you see that...
One second.
You do see that when it ultimately is destroyed or taken, it's not pinned on the second crook. You do see that. It's pinned on me. When there's two crooks involved, the first case we did, I steal it from Jack, and then Bob comes the next day and steals it from me, and then the king takes it. So in that case, I'm the one. It's not Bob that has to pay you back. Even though you could say, well, it was due to Bob that the thing ultimately was destroyed. That's true. That may now have, but that really is looked at as a conclusion of the fact that I severed the relationship between the real owner. It is interesting. Why don't you say in that case that we both have to pay half? That's a good question. Why don't we say in that case where I stole the field from Jack, and then Bob takes it from me, and then the king confiscates it. So why do we both have to pay? Why is it all on my shoulders? That's a good question.
But you both had equal cause in the end result.
Well, we didn't. I got to pay for the whole field myself. I only took it away from you. Somebody stole it from me, and then the king took it from that guy. So why don't I and Bob, the two crooks, why don't we split up the loss?
Oh, in that case, you're saying that the second one is the one that has to pay, or the first one?
The first one, me. I originally.
The one that removes the original ownership or access from the legal owner.
Right.
It already removed. The second person that came along didn't really do anything.
What do you mean? It was only because of the second one that the field was confiscated and now considered like it's destroyed. That field's not coming back. The king has it, you don't get it back.
Right, but the first one didn't remove the ownership from the original owner, then
I understand.
The second one was,
I understand
that. Had access to it.
But if I didn't throw the vase off the roof, you couldn't have removed the pillows and broken it, right? But there, both of us are obligated. I throw a vase off the roof that doesn't belong to me. And some stranger comes along and removes the pillows. We both have to split it. So why doesn't it the same thing relate in this case? I remove you from your field. Somebody now takes the field from me, and then just it's destroyed. The king takes it, whatever. Why is it now in that case the first crook is the only one that has to pay? I don't have an answer. Okay.
Our field, you know, doesn't get removed from where it is. There's some kind of difference there between the field and the vase. Maybe that's part of it.
Rabbi?
Yeah, Doug.
So, in the case of a property, once it's stolen the first time, it's stolen. So the owner has incurred the loss. And so it's held the responsibility of the first person. But in the case of the vase, when the person starts to throw it off the roof with the pillars there, there's no loss. The loss is brought about by the combination of the throwing it off the roof and the removal of the pillows. If the pillows had not been thrown or not been pulled, there would not have been a loss.
Right. He said because the
two are held equally liable because that's what initiates the loss, the combination of those two actions.
Right, exactly. He says that this is all talking about causing damage of money, not removal of ownership. Right, this seventh chapter is about damaging the property itself. I mean, in the second, and in that, you're right, and in that case, both are equally involved in the damaging of money. The ownership is not the issue in this point, that I removed it from his ownership. That's not what he's talking about there. So you're right. So they come together. But what about in the case of the field? There's a person who removed the ownership, the expression of ownership, so it's different. So somehow we're going to have to explain how the removal of ownership is really, all the onus is on that guy.
Well, wouldn't the onus be on him because he was the one who removed ownership? The second guy didn't do that. The ownership was removed regardless of whether the second guy came along.
So we'll have to see if there's a similar case. If I steal a vase and throw it off and so on, would we have the same case? We'll have to look into it. That I don't have the answer to. There's a lot on this. We'll have to look and see. But it's clear that in those in Chapter 7, that's where he's talking about just damaging property. He's not bringing, he's stealing it. That's in the case of stealing and loss. That's in those laws. So I'll have to look through it more and see how this all relates. There's a lot going on. It's interesting, though. We're starting to see a breakdown in terms of, you know, what exactly causes liability. So before we had the discussion, you know, we didn't have this distinction between removing the expression of ownership and the destruction of monetary value. But now we see clearly this category, and there may be more.
And I assume we have to establish all that clarity before we can answer the question about falsely writing term papers and so on.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get to, you know, and we'll get the rules that we'll be able to apply to that case, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
We'll see also, maybe if you want to write some notes down, if
there's a percentage involved that causes culpability, or even if I'm 1% involved, but if that 1%, you know, is it the quantity of involvement? Is it the quality that it was, indispensable to the destruction of it? Because I am indispensable when I throw a vase off the roof. Without me launching it, moving pillows around on the ground is nothing. And without moving the pillows, so then there would not have been a destruction. So they both seem to be equally involved, like Mane says. Like he says that two of them are the cause of the destruction. He doesn't say how much. They both seem to, they both have a role as contributing to the damage. So if you want to look over, you have the areas now. And you can think into it more. We'll pick up. We'll see now how we go back, Kahelis in this, but since the question came up, I felt it, appropriate to go into it. It's interesting itself. So maybe we'll do this for sure next week again. But we'll see how we go in terms of, when you want to get back into Kahelis, you'll tell me. All right?
Okay. I appreciate you now.
Okay. All right, so everybody have a good week. And we'll pick up next Sunday. Same
thing. Yeah, thank you.
Sure, my pleasure.
Good Hanukkah.
Okay, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.